You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The Gaza Freedom March was organized to focus attention on the one-year mark of Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip. The attack killed more than 1,400 Palestinians and injured another 5,000. The marchers had planned to enter Gaza through Egypt's Rafah crossing in late December. However, the Egyptian government announced just days before the 1,300 delegates began arriving in Cairo that the march would not be allowed to proceed. The government claimed that they were closing the border for security reasons. The delegates countered that their action was peaceful in nature. When marchers demonstrated against the decision, the government cracked down. Joel Bainin is professor of Middle East history at Stanford University, and he's joined me by phone from Portland, Oregon. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
Now, what exactly happened in Egypt with the Gaza Freedom March?
Well, the march had been planned for a very, very long time before it arrived in Cairo. And some weeks before it was due to start, the Egyptian government notified the organizers that it did not plan to allow them to cross from the Egyptian side of Rafah into the Gaza Strip as they had planned. People came nonetheless. There was quite a bit of commotion in the streets of Cairo, demonstrations. The French delegation, which was quite large, several hundred people, shut down the street in front of the French consulate in the Giza district to the west of the Nile River from Cairo. There was a demonstration in front of the American embassy, which was probably the most roughly handled by the Egyptian police of all of the various protests. There was, as far as I know, only one joint demonstration with Egyptians, which was actually about the issue of Egypt selling natural gas to Israel rather than this thing. At the end of the day, the Egyptian government offered a compromise that 100 people would be allowed to go. The leaders of the march, there were about 350 or so people in the group agreed to the compromise, but then the foreign minister announced that only the good people were going to be allowed to go, and the rest were rabble-rousers and making trouble for Egypt. And so then many of the people who originally agreed to go, in fact, didn't go, and in the end, I think only 65 people actually crossed into Gaza.
Well, with regard to that rabble-rouser comment, was there any validity to that claim?
Well, not by Western standards. Holding peaceful demonstrations in the streets is not considered rabble-rousing, but in Egypt this is a very big deal. You need to get a permit to do it. These folks certainly didn't have a permit. And there is, in my view, something a bit problematic about foreigners coming to a country like Egypt and making demands on the government. I mean, the demands, as far as I'm concerned, were totally righteous and appropriate, and the people of the Gaza Strip are suffering unbelievably, and something needs to be done to relieve that suffering. Nonetheless, when 1,300 and some Westerners come to Egypt and try to force the government, authoritarian as it is, there's nothing to be said about that, but try to force the government to do something that it doesn't want to do, there's no way that doesn't arouse a certain backlash.
Now, why didn't the Egyptian government want to let the protesters into Gaza?
There are several different reasons. First of all, Gaza is controlled by Hamas. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brothers. The Muslim Brothers are internally in Egypt the largest and the best organized opposition force. So the Egyptian government is very reluctant to allow the Muslim Brothers to have anything that they can claim as a victory, which they would if this were to have happened. Secondly, the Israelis have been trying to get Egypt to take responsibility for Gaza. Israel would really just basically like to give Gaza to Egypt. And Egypt, of course, doesn't want to have it because it's an unsolvable problem. There's 1.5 million people there. with virtually no real economic possibility of development. So Egypt is very wary about the idea that the Rafah crossing, which it nominally controls, would be the only entry and exit point from Gaza. Egypt wants Israel to also allow entry and exit of people, not only goods, in and out of the Gaza Strip. And finally, this is, from Egypt's point of view, one of the several means of putting pressure on Hamas to reach some kind of an agreement with the Palestinian Authority, which is in the hands of Fatah, which Egypt feels much more comfortable with.
Now, you've mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood as something that the Egyptian government is concerned about. How legitimate of a threat is the Muslim Brotherhood to stability in Egypt?
That's a matter of debate. In my judgment, ultimately, not a severe threat. They did receive 20% of the seats in the parliamentary elections of 2005. Those were the most free elections in Egypt in many decades, although far from entirely free. Many people who know the scene well judge that the Muslim Brothers, in a real free election, would win something in the range of 30 to 35%, so a very substantial minority, but not a majority. But that could threaten the hold of the ruling National Democratic Party on its two-thirds majority in the parliament. And as long as the National Democratic Party has a two-thirds majority, which the security forces have always made sure that it does, then it can control all the legislation, and basically the president of Egypt, currently Hosni Mubarak, gets what he wants. So that's what's at issue, I think, rather than the Muslim Brothers would win a majority and turn Egypt into an Islamic state. For all intents and purposes, Egypt is already not really secular. The government often tries to outbid its Islamic opposition by Islamizing cultural and political life to an extent which is far beyond what most people in the West would consider appropriate for a state that announces itself as secular.
What about the legitimate political parties, the ones which are not outlawed? What kind of alternative do they offer people in
Egypt? Unfortunately, they don't offer much of an alternative at all. There are about a dozen legal political parties in Egypt, all of them nominally secular, because it's illegal in Egypt to organize a political party on the basis of religion. They are all based in Cairo, among a mostly male elite. None of them have any significant social base beyond that sector. They don't do any kind of broad-based community outreach or organizing, partly because that's illegal in Egypt, but partly also because these folks are the kind of people who sit in their offices and make proclamations and expect people to rally around them. And the Egyptian people have had probably more than enough of that sort of thing, and they don't do it.
Are there no legitimate or healthy political movements in Egypt then?
There are no legal secular political parties. That is not to say there is no healthy politics in Egypt. In my opinion, the most substantial thing that has been going on for the better part of a decade now is a massive movement of workers, which has involved some 2 million people in over 1,700 strikes, protests, demonstrations of various sorts, probably considerably more by now because those figures are at least 6 months old. And this is almost entirely a response to the neoliberal privatization of the Egyptian economy. Back in 1991, Egypt signed an economic reform and structural adjustment agreement with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. One of its main consequences, and that picked up steam beginning after 2003, was to begin to privatize the very large public sector in Egypt. Most major economic enterprises were nationalized in the 1950s and 60s. That process has been gaining momentum, and along with it, the workers' movement has also been gaining momentum. This is massive. It's the biggest social movement in Egypt since the end of World War II, perhaps in the entire Arab world in the same period. The movement does not have a clear national political program or an identifiable national political leadership. It's all very localized. The demands are overwhelmingly economic. It's unusual for people to raise demands about changing the character of the regime, although that does sometimes happen. So on the one hand, this is a very powerful movement, very deeply rooted in local communities and neighborhoods, but not yet able to politically challenge the regime at the national level.
And what about the United States? I believe Egypt is the third largest beneficiary of U.S. aid. What kind of influence is the U.S. exercising to open up this regime in Egypt?
The United States is not doing much more than talking, and not a whole lot of that either recently. In the administration of President George W. Bush, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, went to Egypt in June of 2005, I believe it was, gave a speech that said, in the past we have been in favor of maintaining stability and the status quo in the Middle East, and that's meant supporting or at least tolerating dictatorships. We're not going to do that anymore. Our new program is for democratizing the region. And many people expected that there would be some substantial change in the policy of the United States government as a result of that, including support for reform movements in Egypt. That didn't happen under the Bush administration. Neither has it happened under the Obama administration.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today, Joel.
You're most welcome, Sean.
I've been speaking with Joel Beinin. Joel Beinin is professor of Middle East history at Stanford University.